Sometimes people have a book like Philippians as their favorite. I can understand that. And sometimes books from the Old Testament, like Joshua, because of its inspiring stories, or Ruth, because of its great portrayal of the story of redemption. But rarely do I hear somebody say that James is their favorite book. Now, for what it's worth, my theory is that this is because people like the idea of someone speaking plainly, which is what James excels at. What they're not so sure about is whether they want to be the recipient of that plain speech. Because James is direct, or as we might say, unfiltered. Maybe you have a family member like this, the one who is forever counted on to ask the most awkward question at the worst possible time. I think it was Winston Churchill who referred to another politician as a bull in search of a china shop. There's good reason to believe that the letter of James was written very early, within less than a decade of the crucifixion of Jesus. This James was, as according to the Bible, a brother of Jesus who grew up under the same roof. It's interesting to me that the tensions and the problems that James addresses in his letter emerge so very early. Even within the very first generation of Christian believers, there came to the surface these misunderstandings and distortions, and they weren't over trivial matters either, as we'll see. I don't know about you, but it's often easy for me to kind of romanticize the era of the early church as if those folks lived in a golden age, where the Spirit was rolling through the church day after day like a wave, and the main challenge for those believers was to get up every morning and catch the wave and ride it from one exploit to the next. But we know it wasn't really like that. And people like James had to dig in and take on the often thankless task of getting people back on track. Because in this letter, and you'll see it right away, there is a kind of corrective tone. As if he's saying, don't you see what is happening? Can't you see how that by letting this path continue, by getting acclimated to what's happening in the church, you're losing contact with the Spirit of the one who called you in the first place? And so there's this need for correction and restoration. And there's the need for a confident voice of a shepherd who is firmly and decisively calling the flock back to go in the right path. And there's no trace in James of, well, you might want to consider this or try that. It's not like that at all. He's telling them this is what needs to happen. So that need for correction in one form or another is never far from any of us. The issues, of course, vary dramatically. They didn't have to worry about, in James's time, about the challenges of a mass culture or social media. And we don't have to think too much about food sacrificed to idols, do we? But that need for constructive correction is always there one way or another. We need someone to tell us the truth about ourselves and call us back to a better way. So here in the chapter, second chapter that Todd read so vividly, James sets out a series of questions as if to say, ask yourself this, brothers and sisters. And I want us to consider briefly three of these questions. Two of them are explicit and one is implied. And bear with me because I'm kind of paraphrasing these questions for our time and our place. Question number one. James asks them, what about that platinum membership plan in your church? Listen to what one author says about the backdrop to this chapter. He says, in that time, a small group of wealthy landowners and merchants had accumulated more and more power, while large numbers of people were forced from their land and grew even poorer. Another writer estimates that 90% of the population in that place, in that time, lived at what we would consider the poverty line or below. Think about that, 90%. And so the issue that James addresses at the beginning is no abstraction. It's not hypothetical at all. And it's also clear that in addition to a financial or economic imbalance, there is a huge imbalance of power as well. The very people that the church that James was writing to, the very people who they were trying to curry favor with, were the ones most likely to bring harm to the church. It's no wonder there was this need for correction. Now, all of us know that in the time when we live, an economic imbalance is still part of the fabric of our lives. Some have more, some have less. Some have more opportunity, some have less opportunity. And any church needs to ask ourselves, in the middle of a situation like that, are we being helpful or not? Do we end up tragically being emblematic of the status quo, a church representing privilege instead of redemption and help? Or does a church seek out ways to be a redemptive force, which is a very, very difficult thing to do? I mean, it's one thing to have the will to help and even to have the resources to help, but that doesn't mean we know what help looks like. And so James speaks right into the middle of that. And we can all see that in this first part of James chapter 2, economic disparity, the church's having forgotten its mission to show a better way, is definitely what's at the forefront. But we also know, don't we, that economic disparity is not the only kind. It's not the only way to show preference for some people over others. We can do that because of different levels of education. We can do that over politics. We can do that over culture. We can even do that over theology, as if my theology is better than yours, or my Jesus is better than yours. Nobody means for this to happen, and yet sometimes, tragically, it does. All of these things can not only become points of discord, but can end up creating boundaries, defining who's in and who's out, defining who's genuinely welcome and who is not. And most importantly, they can define who is valued and who is disregarded. And so, in a way, James's question was, what kind of demographic is most important to you and why? You might say the flip side of this question is, what does welcome even look like to all different kinds of people? Nobody's pretending that what signals welcome to one person or one group does the same for somebody else. It's a challenge. And nobody's also pretending either that affinities or common interests don't play a role, as they should. We have more in common with some people than with others, and that's not a bad thing. I think if we're honest, none of us is wired to feel completely at home in any old church or any old community because we're all different. But sometimes those affinities can become self-justifying, can become self-perpetuating, even turning into practices and policies. So a question for me to ask myself is, what does how I value people tell me about myself? Who am I prepared to go out of my way for, and who am I not? Who is it most easy for me to find excuses for ignoring? It's never healthy for me or for any group to lose sight of questions like this, and that is part of James's message of correction. To put it more positively, what tangible actions that I could take would be most welcoming to someone I would normally disregard? James writes these words, "Has not God chosen those who are poor in the world to be rich in faith and heirs of the kingdom?" What do James's words tell us about how to esteem others who are not wealthy or powerful, well-educated, otherwise privileged? So our first question to James is, what about that platinum membership plan of yours? Which leads us to a second question, which I think is at least implied in verses 9 through 13. I don't remember when it was, it doesn't matter, but I saw a cartoon someplace a few years ago where there was a sign outside a church, and the sign was offering timeshare memberships or lite, L-I-T-E, membership options. And one of the options was including letting people select which seven of the Ten Commandments they would abide by. Of course, it's absurd, but we can see the point. Because we want to appeal to people. We want to bring people in, and sometimes in that pursuit, we become more elastic than we have any business being. To come back to the first part of the chapter, things like partiality, preferences and discrimination or favoritism, shortcomings or oversights like that, we can explain them pretty easily, maybe even innocently, on the basis of our own peer groups or even by the neighborhoods we live in. It's true. We all have a context and a whole bunch of different factors combine to define the world we live in personally. And if we're honest with ourselves, we often think of lapses of that kind, like preferences or partiality, as pretty benign compared to the ones that James mentions. Adultery, murder. And yet, verse 10 tells me that my failure to be impartial is just as grievous as those other breaking those other commandments. Verse 10, if you show partiality, you are committing sin and are convicted by the law as transgressors. For whoever keeps the whole law but fails in one point has become guilty of all of it. What the Apostle James is telling me, it's not my prerogative to define God's requirements by transgressions I'm the least likely to commit anyhow. Meanwhile, completely ignoring what's expected of me within my everyday routine. What's expected of me where even small actions bear out how I value or don't value the people around me. The section concludes with the statement, mercy triumphs over judgment. And if that sounds familiar to you, you're probably thinking of the parable of the unmerciful servant in Matthew 18. Mercy triumphs over judgment because it is in extending respect and mercy to those who are most in need of it that we are in step with the ways of God toward us. Mercy triumphs over judgment. Third and last provocative question. Your faith, what difference does it make? What difference does it make? These verses, I'll be honest, are the most notorious and controversial in the entire letter. These verses are sometimes seen as being in tension with the teachings of Paul, which is pretty strange because at the times when James were written, I don't think the letters of Paul even existed, but he still gets that hung on him. You'd probably be surprised, maybe not, at how much has been written about these verses at such length, in such depth, and in such complexity. It's like a real thicket to try and hack through it. But at the end of all that, it's also true, I believe, that the meaning of James' teaching is plenty clear enough for us to grasp and respond to. Let's talk for a minute about empty gestures. Maybe you've been on the receiving end of empty gestures. Maybe you've been on the giving end of empty gestures. Either way, we know them when we see them, don't we? Go in peace, be warmed and filled, instead of lifting a finger to help somebody. When I say something like that, it does the person in need no good at all. I'm only trying to reassure myself, that I'm more concerned, more compassionate, more conscious than I really am. It's really not much better than when Facebook reminds me to send good thoughts. Not that I would ever do that. We're deeply aware of the challenge here between belief and action, between a creed and actual initiative. We're aware of the need for the right balance between complete dependence on God's mercy on one hand and the deep needs of those around us on the other. But I think we can understand the issue well enough to respond. Let me map it out this way. First of all, it is good and it is necessary that our faith be proclaimed with our words. In just a few minutes, we'll say the creed together. Second, it is integral to our faith that it always be understood as freely received as a gift from God, completely aside from our own merits or worthiness. But it's also true that it is to be expected that our public declarations of faith and our humble acceptance of God's gift will be given expression in the everyday actions of our lives. Faith that can be heard and faith that can be witnessed. When I ask myself these three probing questions, what about a platinum membership plan? And so on. Do I set some of God's requirements at a different priority than others? Does my faith make any difference? I have to be honest and say that my uneasy response is something like guilty as charged in all three. Because I do sometimes show partiality. I do see some encounters as more strategic or more rewarding than others. Because I do pay more attention to the transgressions that would be more likely to result in public embarrassment or disfavor. And it's true that I do sometimes have a preference for expressions of faith that have way more to do with checking off the right boxes than acting for my neighbor's good. But even with that, what's the point of that awareness of guilt anyway? James didn't write and send out these words of his simply to trigger feelings of remorse. What would be the good of that? As you may remember, I lost my mom last December. There are many timeless memories, and one shining example she left with me was a unique capacity to treat others with respect and dignity. And she did this in a unique way. My mom did this by drawing people out, by asking them questions about themselves, by finding something interesting in them, almost without exceptions. Now, only if you've lived without that, if no one has ever asked you questions about yourself, if you've never been treated as a unique and interesting person, only if you've lived without that, will you appreciate how revolutionary an encounter like that could be. It can change the course of your life. It can leave you with an entirely new estimation of who you are. Now, that wasn't perfect, not by any means. And as a family, we share memories of when my mom tried to discover things in people that weren't really there. But her resolve was, I would say, pretty well unlimited. And it was curious, it was intriguing to see her do this with complete strangers. As I say, it wasn't perfect, not by any means. All the same, it was one way, and it was her way, not only of being impartial, but of going beyond that and esteeming people, something like the way Jesus did. Now, that might not be our way, but that's one way. And each of us can find our own way to live that out. So who knows what encounters the week ahead will bring. There may be things on your calendar. There may be other things that come along completely unlooked for. Now think about those encounters and let's ask ourselves together, what grace might be extended? May each of us approach the week to come with a prayerful spirit, asking that God may make us alive and alert to whoever might cross our paths. And may we move into the week ahead with expectancy, looking to God that he may be present in our actions, in our words, in our capacity to listen for the timely benefit of those around us. In the name of the Father, and the Son, and the Holy Spirit. Amen.